Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Do you like your alone time? Do you like the peace and quiet of complete solitude? How long do you think you'd be okay being completely alone? A few days? Months? Years? What about the rest of your life? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I love being alone. Silence is often my favorite sound. I revel in the quietude of no outside demands, questions, or needs, but only to a point. After a while, my brain starts to go, hey, where is everyone? Boy, it's a little too quiet. I think I need to play a zombie shoot-'em-up game with my husband scrolling on his phone next to me and my kid yelling on his VR in the next room. I can only take my own company for so long. Eventually, I can't stand the sound of my thoughts. Maybe that's why I've been watching so much Law & Order SVU. As you know by now, I started watching SVU from the beginning this past December because I am an actual lunatic. In case you're interested, I'm on season 13. I've learned a lot. Mariska Hargitay looks gorgeous no matter what haircut she has. It's actually unfair. The team solves the case incorrectly no fewer than four times before getting it right each episode. And if the show is to be believed, people are a lot more evil and depraved than I thought. But also, there's an episode in which Stabler decides to spend 3 days in solitary confinement in a prison so he can see what it's like. Because, you know, that's totally something a cop would do. Just like when Olivia tells a victim she won't rest until she gets justice. I mean, yes you will, but it's a nice fantasy. Anyway, Stabler goes crazy in solitary. After a montage of him working out, which I didn't mind, he starts hearing voices and at one point befriends a cockroach, which I absolutely did mind. When the guard comes to let him out, Stabler nearly attacks him, yelling that he's said to leave him in there for 3 days, not a whole week. The guard is like, whoa, dude, that was 3 days. But who can keep track of time when one only has one's own brain and a cockroach for company? Stabler chose solitary confinement out of a sense of moral obligation to the perps he helps put there. But most people wouldn't choose a life of complete solitude. Anchorites and anchoresses, though, did exactly that. An anchorite or anchoress is a person who elected to have themselves anchored to a church or community by way of a church by committing to live in what was usually an extremely small living space attached to a church. I first learned about anchorites at a writer's retreat where a fellow retreater shared a chapter from a bodice ripper type love story she was writing set in 17th century France, in which a young woman who'd vowed to be walled into a cell for the rest of her life instead falls in love and escapes to ride off into the sunset with her lover. I was like, LOL, why would someone vow to be walled into a cell? And that's when I learned it was an actual thing that people did. And some still do. I'm going to use the term anchorite throughout to denote both genders, just for my own sanity, even though it seems the majority of anchorites were women. In order to set the stage, we must bring our minds back to the Middle Ages. My go-to image when conjuring up this era is Eric Idle pushing a wagon full of bodies and hollering, "Bring out your dead!" If you don't know the reference, I urge you to Google it. I don't have time to explain it.
Bring out your dead!
Here's one.
Ninepence.
I'm not dead!
What? Nothing. Here's your ninepence.
I'm not dead!
The Middle Ages were a filthy time marked with plagues and pestilence. The people of the Middle Ages didn't have the benefit of things like vaccines or know the germ-thwarting properties of masks like we do today. Thanks, science, am I right? They also didn't have indoor plumbing or basic hygiene or even really an understanding of the human body and things like germs and bacteria. Every other day, there was some new disease sweeping people into the arms of death at rapid speed. And the feudal system under which everyone lived ensured that the poor stayed poor, and the rich stayed rich, and ne'er the twain shall meet. Ugh, can you imagine? So people were sick a lot. Like, a lot, a lot. People had 10 babies back then, not so they could be on Mom Talk and vlog about hashtag broodlife, but because, one, they knew that at least half of those kids wouldn't live to see 5 years of age because of all the disease and filth and horribleness, and two, they needed the other half to bring in money or help on the farm so they wouldn't all starve. So, frankly, the idea of living secluded away from all that death and dying isn't so hard to understand, especially for women whose options were, limited. Many women were forced to marry young and have all those kids only to be worked to death, if the germs didn't take them first, in between giving birth and grieving their dead babies. Honestly, if my options were, one, live among the masses of constantly sick and dying and also be married to someone you may not particularly like and also pump out as many kids as possible, many of whom will die, or B, live in a small cell all by yourself for the rest of your life, where you have basically no rules or guidelines and can pretty much do whatever you want as long as whatever you want can be done in the confines of a really small cell, I'm going with B each time. I choose the bear, and I choose the cell. Sometimes I say things like that just to weed out listeners. LOL. And so, if someone decided they wanted to opt out of the daily grind, whether they were a woman or a man, or both, or neither, their options were few. They could become a clergyman or nun, they could become a hermit in the wild, or they could become an anchorite. There may have been one or two other options, but I can't think of what they might be, and I'm not an historian. That first option, becoming an official member of the church, came with a massive set of rules. Clergymen and nuns lived by a very strict set of rules that pretty much governed every waking minute of their lives. Hell, I'm sure if they dreamt about something ungodly, they had to confess, so technically I suppose their sleeping lives were governed as well. For those who may have preferred not having all their movements dictated by God, but who still really, really dug God, they could either go live in the woods or in a small cell attached to a church. The idea of a devoutly religious person living in solitude under extreme austerity is very, very old. Hermits were religious recluses who generally lived in seclusion out in the wild. They would often be tasked with jobs like paving roads or fixing things in the community. According to the BBC podcast Making History, it was even considered a status symbol to have your own hermit. So rich people would take on a hermit to live on their property, who they could trot out to guests for oohs and ahs. They're all out on a fox hunt when suddenly a bearded, dirty, disheveled guy in robes pops out from behind a tree, and Lord Fartherington or whatever is like, "Ah, yes, 'tis indeed Robert the Hermit of Fartherington Manor." And everyone gives a small golf clap and drinks brandy and feels good about themselves. Anyway, according to Dr. Hilary Pearson in a talk she gave at St. Stephen's Church in Canterbury in 2021, self-imposed religious exile started in the first century after Christianity was founded when Christians were being persecuted for their beliefs. Not like they're being persecuted today by being disagreed with or reminded about the separation of church and state. No, these early Christians were actually persecuted for their beliefs, as in hung on a cross, tortured, drawn and quartered, and all other manner of hideous, painful death. Because of this, says Dr. Pearson, the early mothers and fathers of Christianity would hide out in caves in the desert on the edges of Egypt and Syria. Jesus did a form of this after he was baptized when he went to the desert for 40 days. In the early days, when one was killed for one's Christian beliefs, they were considered a martyr, which of course was the ultimate sacrifice one could make for their God. But as Christianity gained in popularity and indeed became the dominant religion in some parts of the world, martyrdom became a less attractive option. People do generally prefer to live if they can. So the church needed to come up with another form of sacrifice one could aspire to prove they were super into God. That new method of devotion, it seems, was becoming a hermit, recluse, or one of these desert wise people. Pearson describes these desert dwellers as being, quote, "widely valued for their wisdom and spiritual advice," end quote. One such wise person of the desert was an escaped slave named Alba Moses, who converted to Christianity after engaging in some light thievery. Actually, I don't know the extent of the thievery. Pearson described him at that point in his life as simply a robber. Anyway, after his conversion and baptism, he went into the desert and eventually became a monk. When a young monk came to him seeking wisdom, he said, "Go sit in your cell, and your cell will teach you everything." And of course, as we've learned, we humans have a tendency to either misinterpret things, take things at face value, or fail to consider nuance. We usually default to believing what we're told or whatever the most popular narrative is. Like when everyone believed that the Beatles were really just four fun-loving, single, silly goose guys who wanted to hold your hand after a hard day's night because that's what their record label wanted us to think. When in reality, they had wives and girlfriends and children back home who were like, remember us? And also that John was a heroin addict who beat his wife. My point is, a lot of times we're really wrong about stuff because we take images at face value and fail to consider there might be something more complicated lurking underneath. So I'd venture a guess that Alba Moses did not mean go sit alone in your cell for the rest of your life, but probably something more along the lines of go sit in quiet contemplation for a while and the answers will come. But we love to get carried away. And so over time, that lesson apparently came to mean go sit by yourself for the rest of your life. And thus, ancretism was born. Once someone who'd chosen to be an anchorite could show that they had the financial means to take care of themselves, either with their own wealth or with the help of a patron, and were then approved by the church folk in question, a small cell would be built attached to the church, or the anchorite would take over a cell previously occupied by the church's former anchorite. I didn't know this until now, but apparently it costs money to become a nun. I just thought you'd kind of showed up at the nunnery door and said, "I'd like to marry Jesus, please." And then they gave you a robe and a belt and a guitar before shipping you off to become a nanny to a bunch of Austrian kids whose startlingly handsome newly widowed father walks around ripping up Nazi flags. Listen, stranger, this topic is super history heavy, and I'm trying to spare us all the task of trying to pay that close attention. So I'm doing my best to make this a fun romp while you do your dishes or shop for groceries or pretend to watch your kid's soccer game, or whatever you do while you listen. I hope you're enjoying yourself. I'm having a great time. Okay, so a nun couldn't just show up and become Sister Maria von Trapp. She had to give money or land or something else valuable. More valuable, that is, than herself. I suppose it makes sense if you think about it. It takes money to keep a person alive. The same also applied to prospective anchorites. They had to prove that they would not be relying on the church to keep them alive, but could either bring their own funds or, more likely, have a benefactor who would underwrite their anchoriting. This is like me finding out that if I want to get Irish citizenship, I have to show them I can take care of myself and my family financially and not live off the government's teat. By the way, Ireland, I absolutely can take care of myself and my family. In case you haven't heard, I have a very popular podcast that affords me pretty much the basics, and that's it. And I don't need much, just a potato or two once in a while. They also received donations from people looking to have their own mortal souls saved by the anchorites' prayers. Some anchorites had patrons who basically underwrote their anchoriteship. An anchorite was considered a status symbol, so if a rich person could afford to sponsor an anchorite, they were effectively giving their church more clout. An anchorite could also take payments or donations from the community in exchange for their prayers. So you could bring an anchorite some alms or some porridge or whatever and be like, "Can you pray for my Uncle Bob?" And she would, and your Uncle Bob would be saved. This also meant that the anchorite was venerated by her community. In a time when women weren't exactly valued, unlike today, a woman who dedicated her life to the worship of God was not only closer to God than average folk, but could also literally help you and your Uncle Bob get into heaven, which is, not for nothing, pretty badass. Some women can help save your souls, others can make you laugh by writing dick jokes about aliens. Both are equally important. King Henry III supported many anchorites with money or material goods such as firewood. I have nothing else to say about Henry III except he was apparently an incredible anti-Semite. That has nothing to do with the story, just pointing it out. Moving on. Okay, so once someone came to a church and asked to be its anchorite, a ceremony was held, and if there wasn't already an anchor hold attached to that church, one would be built. Otherwise, the new anchorite would move into the existing anchor hold. The ceremony was basically a funeral ceremony as a symbol that the person being anchored to the church was effectively dead to the world, except for the part where they were financially supported and did actually commune with the outside world in order to give wisdom and guidance and take requests to pray for your Uncle Bob's soul. When I say these rooms or cells were small, I mean that in some cases they were only 8 by 8 feet, though some were closer to 8 by 12. And there are instances in which an anchorite may have had a few adjoining rooms. A commonly held belief is that anchorites were literally sealed into their cells with no door. This is almost definitely incorrect and may have come from misinterpretation of texts suggesting the anchorite would be symbolically sealed into their cell and/or from Gothic fiction in which anchorites were literally bricked into a cell with no escape. Listen, I may be wrong. Lord knows I am frequently. Like that time I mispronounced a city in Colorado and no fewer than 5 dozen people messaged me about it. Thanks for that, by the way. It would have been super embarrassing to go to Estes, Colorado, saying Estes instead. I challenge you all to pronounce some of the Rhode Island town names right. Good luck. Where was I? Where am I? Oh, right, the 5th century AD. The anchorite's life was devoted to God. She would spend most waking hours in prayer or in reading the Bible, though some also engaged in writing and weaving and other hobbies. After all, one can only pray or read the Bible so long before one needs a break, I would imagine. I don't know. I have very rarely done either. Indeed, one of the earliest surviving English language texts written by a woman is a book called Revelations of Divine Love by anchoress Julian of Norwich in the late 14th century. The anchorite's cell generally had 3 windows, one that looked out onto the church dais so she could attend Mass, one from which she would receive visitors seeking prayers, guidance, or wisdom, and one from which she could pass and receive things like laundry, food, and chamber pots. I would hope that the person charged with cleaning the anchorite's chamber pot also received some extra points with God. But it wasn't just closeness to God and street cred for all that soul-saving that drew women to anchoritism. Believe it or not, for some women, the choice of being walled into a small cell for the rest of their lives with very little material wealth or contact with the outside world beat the alternative. As I said, options for women in general weren't great in the early centuries after Christ, or the ones before him, or the later ones after him. Take, for instance, Yvette of Huy. According to a piece on the website The Collector by art historian Marie-Madeleine Renaud from June of 2021, Yvette of Huy was a Belgian girl who lived around the end of the 12th century. Quote, Yvette wanted to become a nun, but her father, a wealthy tax collector, forced her to get married at 13. Yvette so ardently despised marital duty that she desired the death of her husband. Her wish was answered 5 years later when she became a widow. She refused to remarry and started caring for the poor and for lepers. Yvette spent almost all her fortune doing so, although her family tried reasoning with her by taking her children away. Instead, Yvette left everything to live in a cell among lepers. The saint became famous thanks to her devotion and the wise advice she gave. Devotees gathered around her cell and gave large donations, allowing her to supervise a hospital's construction. End quote. With this in mind, it's not hard to understand why a young woman might have chosen to be walled up alone for the rest of her life. In fact, it turns out she had to get permission from the bishop not to remarry. Could you imagine only getting your freedom when your husband dies and having to ask a bishop's permission not to go back to slavery, which is apparently what Yvette called marriage? If you can't imagine it, don't worry. We seem to be sliding precipitously back toward those days as we speak. Actually, do worry. Do worry a lot. Though I will admit this passage does make it sound like lepers were living in the cell with her, which is both hard to imagine and also probably not true. According to the Encyclopedia of Medieval Women by historian Jennifer Lawler, Yvette lived in a leper colony for about 10 years before becoming an anchorite in the leper colony. Lawler writes, quote, "The leper house became a community for women where they enjoyed relative freedom of action," end quote. Yvette actually shared her cell with a maid, which was not uncommon. She lived in a cell with another woman for 37 years. I'll let you do with that what you will. Eventually, Yvette became so popular with the ladies that the clergy denounced her and were, as Lawler puts it, quote, "clearly pleased when she died." Renaud also claims that many women became anchorites out of a desire for repentance and says several anchorites were, quote, "former prostitutes." And listen, I can't know the hearts and minds of any person, let alone those who lived many centuries and miles away, but I might posit that if women chose the solitude and austerity of anchoritism after being sex workers, it could have been less about repentance and more about just not wanting to do sex work anymore. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that all sex workers don't want to do sex work. I'm suggesting that in a time when options for women were indeed extremely limited, one could imagine how being an anchorite might seem a more attractive option than sex work. I mean, living with lepers was preferable to Yvette than having to remarry. Historian Karen Winstead points out in a video about anchorites that for people who chose the solitary life of an anchorite, they were afforded a room of their own, alluding to Virginia Woolf's book, A Room of One's Own, which posited that if women were given their own space in which to create, they could live a fuller life. Ironically here, the fuller life for the anchorite was almost completely shutting out pretty much everything about life. Winstead points out, though, that even though the anchorite was confined to a small space, it was their space in which they could do whatever they wanted. Where clergymen and nuns were bound to a strict set of rules that governed basically every moment of their lives, the anchorite was free to read, write, or pray to their heart's content any time of the day or night. Eventually, though, some rules and guidelines started coming together, mostly because clergymen were getting a little antsy about how much veneration and respect the female anchorites especially were getting. Also, there were some cases of anchorites getting a little too big for their britches, as it were, and breaking with official church doctrine, which is a big no-no. Take, for example, Catherine Sauve, the anchoress at Chemin de Latte, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing wrong, but come on. From the 15th century, who, only 11 months after being ceremonially shut into her cell, located on the Road of Lattes in France, was condemned as a heretic because she had been telling those seeking her counsel that receiving communion from a bad clergyman, that is, one whose heart wasn't really into it or whatever, provided no benefits upon its recipient. A piece on medievalists.net by Lucie Lomonier has this to say, quote, "The anchoress had allegedly contended that sacraments performed by bad clerics had no effect as these men were not holy. She held that there was no true pope or cardinal since the election of the pope had been contested," referring here to the then ongoing Western Schism. "She had stated that baptized children who died before being able to believe in God on their own were not saved. They were damned. She had asserted that purgatory did not exist. Finally, the chronicle states that she had said that married husbands and wives committed a sin when having intercourse and should repent on every occasion," end quote. Catherine was burned at the stake in front of a huge crowd in the main square near Notre Dame, attended by beaucoup religious officials, including one bishop who apparently couldn't be bothered to attend the ceremony marking the beginning of her anchorship, but who sure as shit made it to her death. So, because of saucy ladies like Catherine, more and more guidelines began to get crafted and distributed. Another naughty little minx was Isolde de Hetten, a 15th century anchoress from Lancashire who lived a life of religious seclusion at St. Mary's Church in Whalley. Isolde lived with not one, but two maids, and reports from her monastic superiors revealed that not only had her maidservants engaged in misconduct, but Isolde herself had been repeatedly leaving her cell, thereby violating the strict rules of her religious enclosure. Once again, I leave it to you to decide what misconduct two maidservants were engaged in. I have my theories. Though legend might have you believe Isolde was dipping out of her cell to go have forbidden trysts, the truth is probably less scandalous, and likely just has to do with wanting to make sure her son married the woman she wanted him to marry, rather than the woman his grandfather wanted him to marry, and also securing whatever generational wealth her family had. Her actions created quite a stir among the monastic authorities, as documented by the abbot of Whalley Abbey, who reported the breaches to the king and ultimately called for the closure of her anchor hold. And so, because of these kinds of acts of impropriety or downright heresy, guidelines began to get written up and circulated, though they weren't the kinds of strict rules the clergy and nuns had to live by. One such text of guidelines from the 13th century suggests mundane things like that the anchorite should wear comfortable shoes and clothing, but also warns them not to do things like go out to dinner or have people over for dinner. So again, when people say anchorites were sealed into these cells, they were, more than likely, not correct. Renaud accounts how King Charles V, quote, requested the presence of the anchoress from La Rochelle, end quote. Although she goes on to explain, he, quote, made her come to Paris and settled her in a nice cell because of her holy reputation, end quote. So it does seem she traded one cell for another. One of the most widely known texts of guidelines is called the Ancrina Visa, or Guide for Anchoresses, also written in the 13th century as a guide specifically for the author's three sisters who became anchorites. The author of the Ancrina Visa is unknown, but according to the website hermitary.com, whoever it was influenced by earlier guides as well as biblical passages. According to the Hermitary, the Ancrina Visa is lengthy and contains a lot of digressions, much like this podcast. One section suggests these eight reasons for becoming an anchorite. Quote, 1. Safety. Outside the anchor hold, a ravaging lion prowls the street. 2. The soul as a brittle container in a crowd. Do not carry a precious vial in an unruly mob. 3. Gaining of heaven. 4. Proof of nobility and generosity. 5. Noble men and women are generous with what they leave. 6. To be private with God. 7. To see more brightly in heaven God's bright face. 8. To have prayers full of life. End quote. And these eight things to spend one's anchorage contemplating, quote, 1. This short life. 2. This difficult path. 3. Our good, which is so meager. 4. Our sins, which are so many. 5. Death, of which we are certain and uncertain when. 6. The stern judgment of judgment day. 7. The sorrow of hell. 8. How great is the reward in the bliss of heaven, end quote. The author also instructed his sisters to read, quote, Inertia's remedy is spiritual gladness and the consolation of glad hope through reading, through holy thinking, or from people's mouths. Often, dear sisters, you must pray less in order to read more. Reading is good prayer. Reading teaches how and what to pray, and prayer obtains it afterward. Quoting Jerome, letter 22, quote, Let there be holy reading always in your hand. Let sleep steal away your book from you as you hold it. And let the holy page receive your drooping head. You must read earnestly and long like this. Everything, however, can be overdone. Moderation is always best. End quote. So pray a lot, but don't pray so much that you can't spend most hours reading. If you're awake, you should be reading. But, you know, don't, like, overdo it. Read all the time, but in moderation. Conversely, the Ancrina Visa also cautions that pretty hands are a sign of idleness, so that the anchorite should spend her free time digging her own grave within her cell. Quote, For herself to look at her own white hands does harm to many an anchoress who keeps them too beautiful, like those who have nothing at all to do. They should each day scrape up the earth of their graves in which they will rot, end quote. Again, this is likely a metaphor. I can't really imagine anchorites were expected to dig a pit in their cell with their bare hands. Then again, who knows? Also, with all that reading and praying, I don't know when they would be expected to have time to dig their own graves. Rather than dig their own grave, however, it seems most anchorites spent their hours in prayer, study, giving guidance and wisdom, and engaging in their crafts and talents. There was Julian of Norwich, who wrote about her divine love affair with God. This text is remarkable for many reasons, not least of which is Julian's ideas of Jesus as both father and mother, which frankly makes a lot of sense to me, but was at the time pretty radical. It also bears mentioning that Julian had two maids who lived with her at different times. The website Q Spirit, which looks at religion through a queer lens, reminds readers that, quote, "These companions are described as her servant or maid, but history suggests that sometimes a same-sex partner was called a servant to hide from social disapproval of homosexuality. Others whose same-sex servants were dearly beloved include the centurion and his boy, Boris, and his servant, George, and good King Wenceslas and his page, Podovin." Julian's live-in companions, Alice and Sarah, are known because devout patrons gave bequests to them and Julian in their wills, documenting the significance of their relationships, end quote. Julian also had a female mentor named Marguerite Kemp, who played an important role in her life. Kemp wrote in her autobiography, which the website claims is the first autobiography written in English, quote, "Much was the dalliance that the anchoress Julian and this creature, Kemp, had by communing in the love of our Lord Jesus Christ in the many days that they were together," end quote. The piece from Q Spirit goes on to explain that scholar Laura Setviet Miles, quote, "points out that both dalliance and communing had a wide spectrum of meanings, from conversation to sexual union. Anchoresses were allowed to have overnight female guests, so it's possible that Kemp stayed overnight in the cell with Julian," end quote. I agree, but also, sometimes, a hat is just a hat. You know what I mean? It's like when the queer studies professor at the university I worked at taught a workshop all about the homoerotic undertones of Lord of the Rings. Sometimes a man's gardener who accompanies him on a quest to destroy the one ring that would rule them all is just a man's gardener who accompanies him on a quest to destroy the one ring that would rule them all. Merry and Pippin, on the other hand, totally gay for each other. Listen, I am all for the idea of a couple or thruple of religious ladies communing in the love of our Lord Jesus Christ while scissoring. And frankly, I can't imagine two women living in a small, confined space together not eventually getting down and dirty. I'm pretty sure that's what Jesus would have wanted for them. I'm just saying, as of yet, no one has found the salacious love letters between Julian and Kemp, like the ones between Eleanor Roosevelt and her friend of 30 years, Lorena Hickok. Listen, strangers, I'm going to need you to go ahead and share this episode with a few like-minded friends because I'm bound to lose a few people who find the idea that Jesus would condone lesbian love offensive. Though honestly, if he didn't condone it, why would he make women so hot? Let's continue before the Westboro Church doxes me. Another anchorite who shared a cell with a fellow anchorite was Hildegard of Bingen from the 12th century, who the website Aikai describes as a, quote, "political and social moralist, musical composer, poet, naturalist, herbalist, gemologist, author of medicinal and botanical texts, and playwright," end quote. Hildegard was given to the church by her parents when she was only 8 years old. Apparently, it was customary in those days for noble families to literally donate their 10th child to the church as a tithe. But rather than placing her in a convent, as was the typical route of the day, her parents chose to place her in the care of an anchoress named Jutta, who, as far as I understand, was only 14 at the time that Hildegard moved into her tiny cell with her. Regardless, Jutta was considered Hildegard's spiritual mother. Hildegard was very sickly as a child, and her family might have figured that she'd get better care in the hands of the church. Dr. Oliver Sacks, rest in peace, would later say that Hildegard may have suffered from chronic migraines, as the descriptions of her symptoms seemed to suggest. Hildegard described visions that would come to her with intense pain. The visions started when she was just 3 years old. In a letter in her later life to a Benedictine monk, Hildegard recounted, quote, "From my early childhood, I have always seen this vision in my soul, even to the present time when I am more than 70 years old. In this vision, my soul rises up high to the vault of heaven and spreads itself out among different peoples, although they are far away from me in distant lands and places," end quote. I guess it was just a happy coincidence that Hildegard had religious visions and was also the family's 10th child. Giving her over to the church was a no-brainer. Under Jutta's guidance, Hildegard learned Latin, memorized the Psalms, and chanted the divine office daily in the tiny cloistered space. They lived austerely. Jutta practiced severe penances like fasting, self-flagellation, and wearing chains under her clothes. Hildegard later gently criticized these excesses, teaching the value of moderation in asceticism, but she also absorbed a deep reverence for scripture and music during those years. By the time Jutta died in 1136, their little anchorite community had grown into a small convent, and Hildegard, now in her late 30s, succeeded Jutta as prioress. She went on to found her own abbey, travel, preach, and correspond with popes and emperors. Hildegard was a prolific composer as well. Her visions of floating into the vault of heaven and seeing all the people of the earth is a common theme in the writings and teachings of anchorites. It's an ironic thought that living in isolation might lead one to feel more connected to humanity. In escaping the trappings of everyday life, it seems many anchorites gained a deeper understanding of life. This makes sense if you think about the various wise men from the various world religions who went into the desert for some period of time and came back like, "Guys, I totally get it now." I once went on a silent weekend retreat. I learned that oatmeal is only palatable with gobs of cream, or in this case, oat milk, and brown sugar on it. A vegan diet makes for one seriously farty yoga class, and apparently it's perfectly acceptable for women to, pleasure themselves in a hot tub with other people in it. But beyond understanding that some people are a little too open, I didn't gain much insight into the human condition in general. That said, I can imagine that cutting oneself off from the general scrum of humanity for a long period of time would make having empathy for all people easier. It's much easier to love everyone when you never have to deal with anyone. That may have been the case with the anchorite who changed her mind after some years in isolation and asked to be released from her holy contract. After a few years away, she then changed her mind again and was like, "Fuck this shit," and begged to be taken back. There were others who went mad, including a French anchorite from the early 14th century who, according to thecollector.com, escaped her cell by the small window to throw herself in the burning oven of the next-door bakery. Believe it or not, there are still some anchorites today, like Sister Rachel Overton in the UK, who has led a deeply religious life for more than two decades, recently becoming an anchorite. She leads a life devoted to the church and her community. Though she doesn't stay isolated all the time, she describes a modern approach to anchoritism on her website, anchorhold.co.uk. Quote, "Looking beyond that picture of the medieval cell, there are some helpful ideas as to how the life might be translated into modern-day life. A life lived with a degree of withdrawal from people around, but not in absolute solitude. A life literally anchored within the local community. A life of prayer governed by a rule of life. A life with very definite points of contact with the world for service. a life that is part of the genre of religious life, end quote. Sister Rachel supplements her income with doing spiritual workshops and retreats. I highly doubt anyone going to one of her retreats would masturbate in a public hot tub. Listen, it makes sense to me that someone might choose to remove themselves from the stresses of everyday life. Sure, life is objectively better than it was in the age in which people more regularly chose to live like hermits or anchorites. We do have the benefit of scientific advancements like medicine on our side, making plagues a far less often occurrence. Women do have more opportunities than they did. I mean, people in general have more options than they did when, unless one was born rich, back in the Middle Ages, one's options were pray, fight, or work. One could argue, of course, that technology, while making some aspects of life easier, has made others immeasurably harder. Like, it's great that we have dishwashers and washing machines now, for example, but it's not like we can spend the time our dishes or clothes are washing with our feet up watching Real Housewives. No, modern-day conveniences only make it so that we have more time to do other work. You have to watch Real Housewives at work while you're pretending to work. It is nearly impossible these days to find any peace and quiet. I will admit that sometimes on Monday mornings, when I wake up with a full week of having to figure out what to make for dinner every night, the thought of living alone in a small cell with nothing to do but read and write and eat whatever meals are given to me doesn't actually sound that bad. And with the proliferation of guns in this country at least, the chances of being shot while engaging in normal everyday activity is alarmingly high, so removing oneself from it all doesn't actually seem that far-fetched. I guess it's why I hope to be reincarnated as a Japanese monk. For those of us who don't have the luxury of complete solitude, I suppose we all have to find the spaces in between the chaos to connect with ourselves on a more deep and meaningful level. Perhaps if we can find a way to be quiet with ourselves, we can find a way to love each other better and, I don't know, maybe actually make things a little better? Thus ends our pilgrimage into Ancretism, and with it, Season 4 of Strange and Unexplained. I hope you enjoyed this rather unconventional episode. I had a good time researching and writing it. Strange will be taking a little break so I can catch my breath. We'll be back in June with all new episodes. Until then, we'll be running some classic episodes. And for those of you who are still tuned in, I want to thank you so much for continuing to listen and support the show. I'm not for everyone. As John Mulaney says, likeability is a trap. I can't tell you how much it means to me when you reach out and let me know you like the show. It really helps counteract reviews like the one I got recently from a man complaining that the show isn't for white Christian men. It's almost as if nearly all other forms of media and society in general wasn't catering to him. So thanks for the love. Share this with a friend, and I'll see you in June with Season 5. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched by Becky Berger, with additional research by me and written by me, Daisy Egan. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8 you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at GrabBag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and GrabBag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.